Future Proof Gold from News Talk.
Say you came across someone motionless on the ground, completely still, and you didn't know what had happened to them. What would you do? I think most people would say they'd go over and help, but turns out if you're on a busy street, you just might not. Would the presence of strangers change how you act? Joining me on the phone now to talk about this bystander effect is Mark Levine. He is a professor of social psychology at the University of Exeter. Welcome to the programme, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Can you define, please, what exactly is the bystander effect?
The bystander effect was something which was first identified by American social psychologists in the 60s. And they did a series of experiments which showed that if they set up an emergency situation, someone having an epileptic seizure, say, or maybe smoke coming into a room, and you were sat in the room or you were the only person who might help, then you were much more likely to help than if there were lots of other people around. So the presence of other people, it seems, somehow inhibits us under certain circumstances from helping in emergencies.
Which, I mean, in some ways that sort of makes sense because you imagine that someone is better equipped than you, or I certainly would imagine that most people might be better equipped than I to help in those scenarios because I don't have any medical background. Have we come up with a reason why people might decide to opt out from helping?
There are a number of different factors, I think, which affect people differently in different helping situations. So sometimes expertise is a thing. You just, if you've got more expertise or more skill, you might be more likely to intervene. But the original idea was that what was happening to people was that the presence of other people would do things like diffuse responsibility that you think, well, other people will help. Or maybe it would do something like give you what's called audience inhibition. You're worried that if you do something, you might look foolish in front of other people.
Wow.
And finally, the final thing that those early psychologists talked about was something called pluralistic ignorance, which was the idea that when these kind of emergencies happen, often it's not really clear what's going on. So that person lying on the ground, are they drunk? Have they had an epileptic seizure? Are they just closing their eyes and resting? So you look to other people to work out whether this is serious or not. And if they're looking to you to see whether you think it's serious or not, everyone's looking at each other. And so nobody does anything.
Right. Okay. Because you don't know the relationship, because if you turn up on a scene, you don't know the relationship of that person to the group. And that turns out to be sort of crucial in terms of how you react.
Yeah, it's a kind of sort of social proof, the idea that you're trying to work out what's happening by looking at other people around you to see whether they think something serious is happening. And so we need to gauge the reactions of others often to be able to tell what's happening in front of us.
Yeah, and that makes sense because every single second of every single minute of every single hour of every single day, we are trying to look at cues to give us context for the information that comes into us. So, a lot of stuff that happened in the 60s, you know, was taken as a sort of gold, and we applied a huge amount of faith in the studies because they got a huge amount of respect and media attention at the time. But since then, we revised a lot of the things that we thought we knew from the 60s because they just weren't actually true, that they weren't being able to be replicated in the real world. Is the bias since the 60s? I mean, this was a thing that really caught the public's attention when there was a murder in, was it New York?
Yes, New York in 1964. A very famous case, the murder of a woman called Kitty Genovese.
Yeah.
By a man called Winston Moseley. And this is something which it was the start of the bystander tradition in a way, because, well, about 2 weeks after the murder, a report appeared in the New York Times which claimed that 38 witnesses had seen this murder unfold in front of them, and they'd watched over a half an hour period while Winston Moseley first raped and then killed Kitty Genovese. And the claim was that nobody had done anything. They just sort of stood in their windows, illuminated so they could see other people watching. And I guess maybe they thought everyone else was going to intervene. And this was the start of the two social psychologists who began this tradition, Bibb Latané and John Darley. They read this report and then they went into the lab and they tried to explore this phenomenon experimentally, the idea that lots and lots of people didn't help. In actual fact, There weren't 38 inactive witnesses to the Kitty Genovese case. It was a kind of, it was a myth or a modern parable, which I think the police chief thought he should perhaps put into the public sphere as a way of trying to get people to be more responsible.
But so there were no eyewitnesses of this murder?
No, there were a lot fewer. So maybe only, if you look at the court transcripts from the trial, they only called a handful of witnesses, and maybe only three or four people ever saw Kitty Genovese and Winston Mosley together. And in fact, lots of people did intervene. So on the first attack, people shouted out and scared Mosley off, and he left and went away. And Kitty Genovese got up and walked around the corner of the building because she happened to live on the first floor of the building outside where she was attacked. And Mosley came back and killed her inside a stairwell round the back of the building where nobody could see. So it Wow. wasn't the case that there were lots and lots of people watching this and nobody doing anything. It was the case that some people did intervene. I mean, it's possible that lots more people heard something, but it certainly wasn't the kind of popular mythological story we've got of this 38 individuals standing alone, illuminated in their windows, watching this horrible thing for half an hour and nobody feeling they should do anything. On the contrary, lots of people did do something, and they didn't actually see the murder in the way that we imagine that they did.
So what has the science since told us? I mean, is this bystander effect real?
Oh, the bystander effect is probably the one of the most robust and reproduced experimental findings in social psychology.
Wow.
So it's clearly the case that under certain circumstances, the presence of others can inhibit us from intervening. There's no doubt about that. The problem really is that we tend to assume that the problem is having other people around, and that if we want to fix the likelihood of people being more disposed to intervene, that we need to fix the problem of the group. That, you know, it's the idea that when we're on our own, we do the right thing, and when there are other people around, then somehow we lose our rationality, we become vulnerable to peer group pressure, or
embarrassment,
stop being so responsible, embarrassment, all those kind of things. And so we focused a lot on that, whereas actually the more recent science shows that it's not the problem of having other people around that we should be focusing on, it's what our psychological relationships are to all those people. And sometimes the presence of other people, if they are, as you say, strangers, and you're not sure what your relationship to them is, then maybe you don't think they're going to support you. But under other circumstances, having other people around who you think will support you is precisely the kind of power, social power, you need to intervene.
I mean, I'd like to believe that there is sort of probably some sort of inverse bystander effect, that in the situation where there's lots of people watching, someone will go, you know, will be the have a go hero, so to speak. And that does happen, doesn't it?
No, it definitely does. A few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, a big meta-analysis was done of all the studies. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these studies which have been done on the bystander effect. And a meta-analysis essentially looks at what the effect size or the likelihood of intervention is in each individual study and combines them all. So it gives you a kind of overview of the whole field. And what it showed is that in violent and dangerous emergencies, then the presence of other people doesn't impede your likelihood of intervening, and can often be the thing which brings intervention. So when it's, and it, that kind of makes sense, because,
yeah,
you know, if you want to intervene in a, it's, if two people are having some kind of argument, they look like there's going to be violence, you know, you're much more likely to feel safe and secure intervening if you go mob-handed, if you've got a group of mates with you who will support you and back
yeah.
you up. So there are circumstances, particularly in violent and dangerous emergencies, where the bystander effect doesn't hold, and where people use the power of the group to be able to intervene rather than have the power of the group inhibit their intervention.
What about rural versus city scenarios? Is there a difference between if you were in a sort of country environment as opposed to a city? Because you're often told these cities are these unwelcoming, uncaring people. And, you know, in New York, you know, you'd step over someone, you know, looking for help because you figured it was someone else's problem.
Yeah, there is evidence to that effect, and it's often to do with a sense of connection that you have with other people. So I guess in more rural environments, you're much more likely to know individuals or feel more intimately connected to them and also the place, and therefore you feel more responsible, you know who the others are, and so the having those people around or being in a place where you feel you've got more ownership, you're much more likely to do intervention. Whereas in big cities, where you might feel slightly less identified with the place, or you might be less likely to know your neighbors, then there clearly is an effect of the presence of others in rural and urban places having different effect on the likelihood of intervention. But what that points to is the importance of the psychological relationships, how identified or how much you feel part of a group or a community with the other folk who are around you.
Right.
And the more you do that, the more you're likely to act in terms of the norms and the values of those groups. And when those norms and values suggest intervention is the thing to do, then you're much more likely to do that.
Okay, so I've been in situations where I've kicked myself for not saying something. Most recently, I was on a long bus ride home and some idiot made some homophobic comment to someone who wanted the door opened on the bus. And I wanted to say something to him, but I was probably too far away. And afterwards, I said, you should have just walked up to him and said, that's not acceptable, because that's, you know, I think sometimes we need to be able to go up and do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
If we look at the scenario where there are people marching with white supremacists in America, or there are people saying racist things on the street, how do we know when to intervene, and what is the effect of intervening in those sort of scenarios for the victim of those comments or those actions?
I think you pointed to the importance of all the relationships which are important in making those kinds of decisions. So the first thing you have to think about is what your relationship to the victim is, how responsible for their welfare, how connected to them.
But should that matter? Should it matter how? I mean, I didn't know this person from Adam that was being, you know, being, I suppose just abused, I suppose. But I didn't know them. So why does it matter whether or not I know them if they're being the subject of either physical or verbal abuse?
I think it makes a difference to how you act. Depending on how responsible you feel for their welfare. And we feel more or less responsible for people's welfare. I guess, you know, we'd expect to feel responsible for our family members. We'd expect to be upset if our family member was abused in some way. And what you want to try and do is make that boundary of the people you feel responsible for as inclusive as possible. So
right.
I think it does make a difference if you kind of think, well, actually, it's bad, but really, I don't have any responsibility here towards the victim. Therefore, maybe I'm less likely to do it. You're also thinking about your relationship to the perpetrator. So, you know, how do I feel about that person? Is doing what they're doing going to shame my group? Are they going to embarrass me? Do I feel that this is something I should take responsibility for? Am I threatened by them? That's another thing. Will it be costly for me if I intervene? And then you're also doing the same kind of thing to the other people on the bus. You're thinking, will these people support me if I do this? Or will they turn away? Or how much can I rely on them? How identified with me are they? So you've got three relationships you're worried about. Relationship to the victim, the relationship to the perpetrator, and the relationship to the other bystanders. And you've got a split second to make a decision.
Yeah, and I suppose all of those decisions are sort of subconscious things. Mark Levine, a professor of social psychology at the University of Exeter, thanks very much for going on.